daily routines and perspectives. U.S. Intel unleashed a campaign of intrusive mass domestic surveillance of all Americans. Terror laws were rewritten, giving authorities the tools to crack down on personal liberties. And wanton demonization of Islam and its followers ensued both on and off U.S. soil. And the adventurism in West Asia in the name of so-called war on terror, curbing policy tailored to collectively punish an entire region while justifying invasions, occupation, violence, and control, and setting a ball in motion which continues to impact entire nations and world politics to this very day. In the Spotlight program, we'll discuss September 11th aftermath and its profound impact on the U.S. and in particular Western policy and regional stability of West Asia. But first, here's a report.
24 years ago, the world watched in horror as attacks struck New York's Twin Towers and the Pentagon. Al-Qaeda claimed responsibility, but for the American empire, 9/11 became more than a tragedy. It became an opportunity, a justification for a sweeping campaign of global warfare under the banner of the war on terror.
Either you are with us, or you are with the terrorists. Any nation that continues to harbor or support terrorism will be regarded by the United States as a hostile regime.
The first target was Afghanistan. Not just all alleged perpetrators, but an entire nation. Bombs fell, infrastructure collapsed, and a U.S.-backed government was installed. 20 years of war ended not in victory, but in retreat, leaving behind devastation and despair.
End.
Then came Iraq. The U.S. sold the war with fabricated claims of existence of weapons of mass destruction. But the true motives? Oil, power, and a desire to redraw the Middle East map. The result? A shattered country. The rise of Daesh or ISIS, and hundreds of thousands of civilian deaths.
Well, there are a lot of people that think that. There were a lot of people that think, look, bottom line, there were no weapons of mass destruction. They said there are weapons of mass destruction.
The war on terror become a self-sustaining machine, fueling arms sales, propping up dictatorships, and justifying drone strikes, detention, and of course, torture camps. A war that created more enemies than it eliminated. Today, on the 9/11 anniversary, we remember the civilian victims in New York, Pennsylvania, and Washington, and those in Kabul, Baghdad, Fallujah, and Sana'a, whose lives were torn apart by the wars that followed. Their blood, too, stains the legacy of the American war machine.
And now for our guests. Joining us, Mr. Don DeBar, activist and commentator from New York. And Daniel Kobelik, author and activist, joining us out of Pennsylvania, both from the States. Gentlemen, good to check in with both of you. Good to see you both are doing well. And I guess we'll start there in New York with you, Don. Good to check in with you. We have over the years developed a number of schools of thoughts on what happened on September 11th and why, from the obvious to what people call conspiracy theories, to sometimes a concoction of a few different narratives that either complement or are consequential narratives. How do you see events of that day?
Well, it's kind of pointless to argue over things that cannot be known. Who did what? We can investigate, you know, as thoroughly as we can, and we're going to know what we know and not know what we don't know. And, of course, what we think we know might actually be the product of some deception or whatever. I think that what is most important is what was done with it in the aftermath, and also what forces would have caused such a thing to happen in the first place. In other words, what historical activity would lead people to want to kill in the financial center of New York in a big, you know, display, in essence, as happened on September 11th. The people who make policy in the United States have shown on a global stage for decades that they are capable of anything, that they will murder tens of thousands of people for profit or power or just to make an example of them. We've seen it from Vietnam to Congo, to Libya, to Syria, to Iraq, Afghanistan, Laos, Cambodia, you could go on and on. The aftermath here, however, was a declaration of war on that part of Asia, and sort of paving the way for the latest adventure of the Israeli state to completely cleanse Palestine of Palestinians and declare war on the neighbors. Looking just at what happened in Qatar in the last 2 days, you know, there's a path that goes from one place to the other. The list that the general, whatever the hell his name was, with Clinton had of the seven countries they intended to invade back in the 1990s, Clark. You know, they've done each one of these things pretty much out in the open with impunity. And yet here we are. I think that we need to figure out a plan to put an end to this already, because I think time is very short, not just for the people in Gaza and in the region there, but for the planet, because this is going somewhere very badly, and it seems like it's going there very soon.
Thank you there, Don. And Daniel, welcome to the program. Thanks for patience. And Daniel, you see why I have to ask how you digest the events of that day, because it's just hard to make assumptions these days. And if one of either you were a conspiracy theorist, I would have to, that would impact our conversation, obviously. But for the sake of this program, let's assume neither of you are. But if you are, Daniel, just speak up now. But anyway, the U.S. post-attack, let's start our conversation. Post-September 11th attacks, the U.S. decides it wants to target al-Qaeda, who it sees responsible for events of that day. We know how that played out. We know that as soon as they went into Afghanistan, U.S. forces, Pakistani intel told them, hey, al-Qaeda has just fled Afghanistan. They're coming into our neck of the woods, including Osama bin Laden. But the U.S. went ahead and stayed there for another 20 years, took the fight to the Taliban instead. Help us make sense of that.
Yeah, well, you can't make sense of much of what the U.S. did in response to 9/11, if 9/11 was the product of what the U.S. claims, which, and let's assume it is. The U.S. claims al-Qaeda was behind it. According to the 9/11 Commission, it appears that Saudi Arabia, which of course is the font of Wahhabism, which created al-Qaeda, apparently Saudi Arabia had some involvement in it. And ultimately, what does the U.S. do? At first, it went after al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, but much broader, as you mentioned, it goes after the entire nation. Even though the Taliban offered to give up bin Laden if the U.S. could show proof that he was involved, which the U.S. did not. And as Noam Chomsky has pointed out, the FBI never listed the World Trade Center destruction on bin Laden's, you know, most wanted designation, because they never had enough evidence, you know. But let's, again, assume it was bin Laden, al-Qaeda. What eventually happens, and this is all recorded in a great article by Seymour Hersh in 2007, he says by 2005, the U.S. completely did a 180 and went from opposing al-Qaeda to using al-Qaeda and similar forces to go after countries in the region that it wanted to regime change in, like Libya, for example, and Lebanon and Syria. And of course, what happened in Syria? Al-Qaeda is now in charge of Syria. And the U.S. backed al-Qaeda in Syria. That's not a conspiracy theory. It's true. And now al-Qaeda is in charge, and the U.S. recognizes that government. So if you believe the U.S. that al-Qaeda was behind 9/11, you cannot make any sense in what they did. And by the way, they decapitated all these governments that opposed al-Qaeda, like Saddam Hussein, like Gaddafi in Libya, went after Iran, even though Iran helped in the war on terror and is a mortal enemy of groups like al-Qaeda. Yeah, and then in Afghanistan, they spent 20 years only to replace the Taliban with the Taliban. I mean, this was a disaster. And at the beginning of your program, it was said hundreds of thousands of people died in these post-9/11 operations. Actually, according to Brown University, over 4 million people were killed in West Asia. I mean, so it was just an unmitigated atrocity, really.
Thank you, Daniel. And Don, we sit back now, we take a look at post-September 11 till present day, over 24 years all throughout the world, not just Iraq, not just Afghanistan, but you look at the insurgency backed onslaught inside of Syria over 10 years. You look at the Saudi-backed war against Yemen, the disruption to Iraq's stability by the U.S., which allowed for the emergence of Daesh terrorists and for them to flourish for a couple of years there. This all the impact, the security that was impacted, I mentioned the Saudi war in Yemen, the persecution of Muslims in Burma, in India, the Gaza genocide. It seems like everything that ensued, the process of Western, how would you put it, the devaluation of the Muslim life led to so much policy and so much, so many things that are related to September 11th without directly being related. Do you understand what I'm saying? They fall under the penumbra of the a trajectory in which the world went post-September 11th, are impacted by that very day, aren't they?
Yeah. For example, there's a judgment, a multi-billion dollar judgment against Iran that was taken in the federal court in the Southern District of New York, claiming that Iran had some remote culpability in what happened on September 11th, and not a single lawsuit brought against the Saudis. Saudi Arabia, the home of 16 of the 19 people supposedly involved or something, Saudi senior government officials being ferried out of the country that day, bin Laden's relatives, friends with the then President Bush's family, and yet they sued Iran, and they got a default judgment against Iran, executed against a $500 million building in Manhattan, for example. It's outrageous, the disconnection from reality that the narratives here allow. People's heads should be exploding from cognitive dissonance every day here in this country, and that's not happening. And most people don't even understand or realize that there's a problem. You know, we're looking at a situation right now where this war that was started with Russia in Ukraine back in 2014 is now, coming close to a shooting war with NATO. Certainly there are people trying to engineer that to happen. And this is at the same time that people invite into Qatar folks from, that are supposed to be negotiating some sort of an agreement between Hamas and Israel. And they basically set them up to be blown up by the U.S. military. It was only some good fortune on the part of a few people that they ended up not in the building, and bad fortune of the people who ended up there. You can't trust ordinary channels of diplomacy. And by the way, these same people want to get Putin and Xi in a room together to meet with Trump. You can't use diplomacy, and you have a war being engineered between NATO and Russia, and all of this happening in the region where you are. I'm aghast. I can't comprehend it. It looks to me like the beginning of another world war on the scale of the last two.
Thanks, sir. Don. And Daniel, I want to talk about some of the domestic stuff in the States. Bush signs the Patriot Act in late October of 2001, legislation which aimed to strengthen the federal authorities' counterterrorism response. Now, this expansive bill, and I'm reading this verbatim, includes provisions to bolster cooperation between law enforcement and intelligence agencies, to strengthen banking regulations to combat terrorist financing, create new definitions and penalties for terrorist activity, put an asterisk next to that, and dramatically expand domestic surveillance. Critics allege law is too broad and was rushed through too quickly. Press reports later revealed massive collection of Americans' phone records by the NSA, you very well remember, based on Patriot Act authorities, which prompted Congress to place new limits on domestic surveillance. Many say the Patriot Act, they see it as a monumental blow to constitutional freedoms. How do you see it? I remember we were all fired up post-September September 11th. And we welcomed anything that would make America safer. And I was in L.A. at the time and more secure. But I'm not sure that that took place in the last 24. We gave up a lot of constitutional liberties, but what did we get back?
Well, yes, and I never welcomed it, to be honest. I mean, I smelled a rat. I saw they were exploiting this tragedy to undermine the U.S. Constitution. Was it Ben Franklin who said, you know, those who sacrifice freedom from security don't deserve either, right? Something to that effect. We lost a lot of freedoms. We lost our privacy. As Snowden would go on to show, you know, there's just a huge surveillance state that grew out of that. They've used anti-terror laws not against terrorists but against people who dissent against U.S. foreign policy, which, by the way, many times support terrorists, as I've already mentioned, right? Supporting, you know, the U.S. has supported Al-Qaeda and ISIS and other groups. But again, goes after people who support Palestine, for example, who want friendly relations with Russia or Iran or Cuba. They're the ones considered the terrorists. So it was a great perversion. Again, both the U.S. foreign policy and U.S. domestic policy were completely perverted after 9/11. Again, whatever the truth is about who caused 9/11, what we know is the U.S. government welcomed it. And was happy it happened. In fact, Cheney said before 9/11, we need another Pearl Harbor, you know, to be able to do what the government ended up doing. So that is very clear.
And I'm glad that Daniel mentioned that, Don, because you know what they're using some of those curbs on personal liberties as a result of post-September 11 legislation? They're using terrorism laws to go after pro-Palestine protesters on U.S. college campuses. And so this is right to Daniel's point about the government using post-9/11 legislation to basically overreach and invade people's privacy.
So I had a friend who was a criminal defense lawyer here in New York. She passed a few years back now. And she represented a man that they refer to as the blind sheik, who was convicted of participating in an attempt to blow up the World Trade Center that supposedly took place in the early 1990s. She represented him in prison, handling his affairs, dealing with the state and such. She had been doing that for a few years before September 11th and before what they refer to euphemistically here as the Patriot Act, I would say, sarcastically. About a month or two after this legislation was passed, John Ashcroft was on Letterman or Carson or one of those programs at night and announced that she was being indicted for giving, aid to terrorists. Long story short, she ended up screwing around with the courts for 3 years and ended up in prison from 2006-2007. For 4.5 or 5 years, a couple of months before she ended up dying of cancer. This was a woman who gave her life to defending poor people and working people from the excesses of the state, particularly in New York City. And she was sacrificed on the altar of this ridiculous hate campaign that was directed to enable the wars that have been conducted in that part of the world. And I only know about her personally, because I knew her personally. I'm sure there are thousands of people in the U.S. and in Europe and other places that are removed from that area who faced similar problems, because the whole point of this legislation was to curb any dissent that could actually impact policy.
And when we talk about the effects and the impacts still evident today in West Asia, Daniel, and I'll put the last thoughts to you. We look about the way the U.S. Imposed itself on the region post 9/11. The couple of wars and the other ones that it proxied itself in and out of from time to time. And we realize that without those taking place, there'd be a good chance that Israel would not be as bold and as reckless in its adventurism as it is today. That's why I'm saying everything is tied together when it comes to post 9/11.
Oh, yeah, no, 9/11 was a boon for Israel. As you say, they've exploited it too in order to try to build greater Israel, which they're doing right now. And we see that they're expanding into Lebanon. They have expanded into Syria. They just bombed Qatar with the support of the United States. They have taken over the border area with Egypt, which they are not entitled to under the peace agreement they signed in the 1970s. They have exploited this too. The U.S. and Israel have exploited this for their own geopolitical interests, and it's shameful. And I think most Americans know that. I think most Americans by now view 9/11 very differently and distrust their government quite a bit as a consequence of how the U.S. Handled it. But now as a populace, we're weaker now to be able to resist it because of all the power the government amassed after 9/11.
All right, thanks, gentlemen. Time has gotten the better of us. I really want to get into the establishment of the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, the TSA, Guantanamo, but time has gotten the better of us. I want to thank you both for joining us. Don DeBar there joining us out of New York, and also Daniel Kovalik joining us from Pennsylvania. This brings us to the conclusion of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to Women of Resistance. Basima Ahmed Abdulrahman Sadur is Syrian, but moved to Gaza when she got married to a Palestinian. Women of Gaza, she says, are incredibly strong and resilient, but are suffering tremendously as the genocide takes the turn for the worse. Biting hunger, loss of children, and constant bombings are taking a toll on a population that is facing complete occupation and being fully erased. Here is more of Basima.
Gaza had always been a beacon for the other regions of the Muslim Ummah. When the situation became unstable in Syria, our next brave voice relocated to the coastal enclave of Gaza. Life really isn't that different whether you're in Gaza or Aleppo. People enjoy the small joys and try to carve out a life for their loved ones. Whether the oppressive power is the Israeli occupation army or ISIS, it's ultimately the most vulnerable who suffer. Education is always the answer, no matter the question. But Basima's tragic personal loss made her own journey into formal learning a shorter one. No one should have to endure what the people of Gaza have been subjected to for nearly 2 years. In the blink of an eye, life for Palestinians and those who had chosen to make Palestine their home changed. The idea of turning tail and giving up Gaza forever is not something that sits well with its people. The strength of Palestinian women has been a sight to behold, to the point where someone who has suffered alongside them recognizes there is a deep steadfastness that refuses to be broken. The current crisis has driven those lucky enough to have escaped the specter of death thus far to the very brink. The lack of support from fellow Arab leaders has been particularly hard to bear. Basma is suffering a double loss. First, of being away from her family home after watching the new home she worked so hard to build destroyed around her. The people living under a genocide need the support of the world more than ever. It's high time Palestine's regional neighbors did more. The moments for carefully chosen words of condemnation towards Tel Aviv have passed. Basma's very life depends on it.
Joining me in the studio today to discuss Basima's story is Dr. Rehana Ali, NHS doctor specializing in neurology, a former parliamentary candidate and a pro-Palestinian activist. Welcome, Dr. Rehana. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Rehana, as you heard Basima's story, you know, what were your initial thoughts?
I think the story is heartbreaking, you know, and it's one of many in Gaza. The fact that, you know, suddenly their lives were changed overnight and let's remember that their lives were not easy in the first place. I mean, Gaza had been under a 17-year illegal siege and therefore the conditions were already pretty horrific. I mean, some people might not be aware that the Israelis had actually planned starvation plus diets for Gazans. So they would actually calculate the number of calories that needed to come in. So when you hear, and then obviously these conditions massively intensified, and over the last few months, there's been a complete siege, humanitarian siege, with practically no food getting in. So when you realize that, you know, babies are being starved to death, I mean, these stories are traumatic to hear, let alone to endure.
Absolutely. Now, you know, Basima says she's Syrian, and, you know, she's now living in Gaza because she got married over there. But she's appealing to her Syrian president and to other Muslim countries who so far have literally just been useless. Is this just a futile appeal from her?
It feels very futile because, first of all, with regards to the Syrian president, you know, Jilani, first of all, he's given way on so many aspects within Syria. And, you know, whilst I know that, you know, in the Sunni world, many have said, oh, well, things will change, but you know, we're talking about the southwest of Syria being effectively been occupied now by Israel, in addition to the Golan Heights, air defences of Syria being completely destroyed. And then on top of that, you've got the rest of the Muslim world, you know, 2 billion people, in effect, as you say, useless, you know, totally useless. And I think in some ways that demonstrates, you know, the problem within the Muslim world. It hasn't recovered, because it almost has become very apathetic, that actually everyone is waiting for the governments of those Muslim countries, and those governments are occupied. So the people are going to have to realize that actually we have a duty. It's a Muslim duty, actually, to liberate al-Quds. And I think, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, people will actually see that it's possible that Al-Aqsa Mosque could be destroyed. They need to rise to that. You cannot wait for your government, and if your government's not doing it, then perhaps they need to be overthrown.
Now, Dr. Rehana, you know, the other interesting thing is Basima talks about the fact that the Palestinians who left Palestine earlier, you know, during the Nakba and in other times, that she says they've made a big mistake because they can't come back now. But she insists that even though we know that Israel has decided to occupy, they say they're going to occupy Gaza, and she says Gazans shouldn't leave, and they won't leave because this was a mistake. What do you think will happen? I mean, if these forces come in and Gazans are not leaving, what's going to happen?
I think it's moving to an all or nothing response. So, you know, in the past, people have always talked about compromise, because that's what the two-state solution was. It was a compromise. We have lost, you know, over 80% of our land. We'll accept Gaza, we'll accept West Bank. And actually, it's always been very clear the Israelis have no intention of honouring even that two-state solution. So it's Israel that's the bad partner for peace. And I think many Gazans, you know, and it's very, you know, poignant that they always carry that key of their homes, that they were going to return, and they can't return. And You know, they feel that they don't want to be refugees. You know, there's refugees in Lebanon, there's refugees in Jordan. They've been refugees for, you know, practically their entire, you know, entire lives. There's, you know, 80, 90-year-olds basically waiting to go home. So I think it's moved, and that's why the resistance was popular. That's why, you know, Hamas was popular in Gaza, because Hamas offered an alternative to basically a stalemate. Because let's be very clear about what October the 7th was. It was breaking of that illegal 17-year siege that the international community failed to do anything about.
Absolutely. I mean, let's come back to the issue of, you know, the resistance and in Gaza. Dr. Rehana, this is also the fact that, you know, these people by now in these 2 years, what they have faced, you know, constant displacements. I mean, the hunger, the loss of children, you know, husbands, wives. Do you think they've just come to a point whereby they have nothing more to lose, and therefore they're just going to stay?
I think there's an element of that. I think, you know, you have to admire the resilience. And I think it's, again, it comes back to that all or nothing. They have lost before. They've compromised before. They've been subjected to the most atrocious bombing, you know, complete devastation, loss. You know, we're talking, you know, scores of family members killed. And now starvation. And they have to... there's a decision point. Do you say we give up, we give up our land that's rightfully ours, or do you continue to fight? Because I think that, you know, the Israelis are deluded if they think that, you know, Gaza is theirs. It will never be theirs.
And this is something we hear from the women, you know, every week when we speak to them, that they will never give up. They, you know, they say even if there's one of us left and there's breath in our bodies, we will never give up. But also, you know, Basima talks about our role, Dr. Rehana, and she says, you know, please don't stop talking about us. Please, you know, fight for us, help us. We are trying, Dr. Rehana. We don't see much change, although there is a change. But there's also a price to pay for that. I mean, you've experienced it firsthand. Tell us what happened with you.
Yeah, so the first thing I would say is that, yes, I paid a price, but I always reminded myself that I wasn't in Gaza. I wasn't being bombed. My family members weren't being slaughtered. And I have always, you know, supported the Palestinian cause. You know, I'm Kashmiri by background. So, you know, we have a commonality in terms of our occupation, you know, with the Palestinians. And it's always been a cause, you know, that's was very close to my brother's heart, who was assassinated in March 2022. So it was a no-brainer to speak up for Palestine, particularly when, you know, as I call it, the Holocaust, you know, started, because they had moved from mowing the lawn to, you know, complete out mass slaughter. And I was attacked by a number of lobby groups. I think I've got a record in the number of lobby groups that have attacked me. And initially, the General Medical Council dismissed them, saying they didn't meet the threshold. But obviously, with Wes Streeting, there's a new health secretary in July 2024, you know, he put pressure on the General Medical Council to, you know, take a different approach. So on my fourth complaint to the General Medical Council, they moved forward, not just with an investigation, but they suspended me before an investigation. So it got to the point where I, it's obviously a long story, but I took the GMC to the court in July. I'm still waiting for a judgment that was due 4 weeks ago. But in addition to that, I had my review in, you know, 6 months, because it's a legal requirement to have a review of that suspension, which I was given for 18 months, which is unheard of for freedom of speech. Bearing in mind, I had never said anything unlawful or illegal in this country. And my suspension was revoked. And I think that caused a lot of surprise amongst many people, because one thing I hadn't done was I hadn't backed down from what I had said. Mm-hmm. Because even though I had not been allowed to work for 7 months with no income whatsoever, there was obviously financial pressure. But my view is that, you know, the cause is actually greater than our individual hardships, and we have to pay that price.
Absolutely.
It's a small price.
Yeah, and I mean, you are a consultant, you know, working for an NHS. If someone like you can suffer that, then you can imagine, you know, what ordinary people can. But Dr. Rehana, you know, do you feel like there is any change? I mean, we all are trying in Western countries, and when I speak to women in Gaza, you know, I feel very upset, and I say to them, we are trying, but I know we are not succeeding in making it stop, because for them it's now and then and dying and starving. Do you see any change? Do you think, for example, you know, you are a member of parliament, that there is a difference, there is hope in the next in the elections? Or do you see a change? Do you think that something is changing around the world?
I think something is changing, but you know, I'm not here for the popularity stakes, so I tend to speak as I see fit. And that, I know, causes, you know, people discomfort, because I tend to be blunt. But, you know, the change has been slow, right? The change, you know, what we're talking about now should have been something we were discussing a year and a half ago. And people were objecting to the use of the word Holocaust when literally that's the case. People were objecting to saying, well, you know, my situation was, why was there such mass slaughter? Why were they targeting children? Why were they slapping kids in the head? What was it due to? Was it just because they were evil people, or did it arise from somewhere? And we know, and everyone knows, but people are afraid to say, Zionism is Jewish supremacy, that there's extremism within Judaism, as there can be extremism within other faiths, but it's one extremism people didn't want to discuss. They were more comfortable saying that it's a political ideology, and yet in the Old Testament and in the Talmud, it talks very clearly that, you know, Jews are human beings and the rest of you are animals or cattle. And that extremism, that extremist element, that has to be dealt with. And people are afraid to speak. And so when you talk about the Palestinian woman and are we doing everything, I would say every single one of us, and that includes myself, are not doing enough.
Absolutely. And of course, if we were doing enough, you know, we would see a situation change in Palestine. Thank you so much, Dr. Rehana. A lot to unpick there. Hopefully, we'll have another session to do that. But, you know, hope is something we can hold on to, and fight must continue. Thank you so much. And we leave you now with The Sounds of Palestine by the artist Saif. Goodbye.
Troubled story, tales full of sadness and woe. But I believe you smile again. You see, I know the pain you're feeling. I was there just like you before, and I know where it's leading. Hold on.
There's nothing standing in your way. You can be strong.
So show the world what you can do.
Like you're the outcast. Sometimes it's better to be alone than to be with the bad crowd. Preserve your mind and feed it. Nourish what it is you have inside. Use it in the right way.
Greetings, dear listeners. You're tuned into Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran, the vibrant capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Here's a preview of what's coming up next on your trusted radio station. Up first, take a moment for thoughtful reflection with Hadith of the Day. Next, we turn to Islamic laws with Hujjatul Islam Sheikh Javed Akbari. This program focuses on Islamic jurisprudential rulings based on the fatwas of the prominent scholars or maraji. Each episode addresses practical religious questions and explores common issues that arise in daily life. Following that, join us for Africa Today. For those seeking to deepen their connection with the Holy Quran, don't miss Let's Recite the Quran. Coming up next, it's the Hadith of the Day. Stay tuned.
Here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no
You are listening to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brother, dear sister, salam and welcome to this episode of the Hadith of the Day, where we let the light of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam guide us inward. I'm your host, Danish. Today we bring you a profound reality check from Imam Hussein alayhi as-salam. A man once told him, I am one of your Shia. And the Imam replied, not with flattery, but with deep truth. Fear Allah and don't claim something that Allah may call you a liar for. Our true Shia are those whose hearts are free from deception, hatred, and corruption. Say instead, I am one of your supporters and lovers. So, as you can see, this sentence, this hadith, tells us a lot, especially in this world today, where you can find many people, some governments who claim to be Shia, but in action, they're not, according to this hadith. The word Shia isn't just a title, it's a responsibility. Imam Hussein alayhi salam is warning us, don't let your words outrun your reality. Don't claim proximity without purification. It's like someone calling themselves a doctor after reading one biology book, or someone saying, I'm a soldier but never entering the battlefield. Titles without truth become lies. The Imam isn't pushing the man away. He's pulling him closer to honesty. He's saying, you don't need to pretend. Just be real. Start with love. Start with loyalty. Imam Hussein alayhi salam defines the true Shia, those whose hearts are free from ghish, deceit, and ghil, hatred, and daghal, corruption, and like cheating, deceiving people. These are inner diseases. You could look religious on the outside, but if your heart is bitter, envious, or fake, you're not there yet. And studies in psychology show that chronic resentment and hidden jealousy, for example, not only damage relationships, they lead to anxiety, heart problems, and depression. When people train themselves to be transparent, to forgive, and to speak truth, even when it's hard, even when it's kind of like against their own interests. They report higher well-being and stronger trust in others. So Islamic spirituality always starts inside. That's why the Quran repeatedly says, on the day of judgment, nothing will benefit except a sound heart. Inshallah, we, you and I, all of us have it. And get closer to Ahlul Bayt and to being a true Shia of them. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, in which we try to deal with some of the jurisprudential laws related to medical issues based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javid. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, let me start with this question, Sheikh. Is it permissible for the woman to use contraceptives without the permission of her husband?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The issue is a bit controversial because some scholars say she has the right to choose whether to become pregnant or not to become. And for example, Sayyid Sistani is of the view that she has the right to choose not to become pregnant so she can use contraceptives. Mm. And there are many other scholars who are of the same opinion. But His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah grant him long life, is of the view that it is problematic in the sense that she must use she cannot use contraceptives without the consent and permission of her husband.
Mm-hmm. This is a general fatwa, right?
This is actually a fatwa given by Ayatollah Khamenei.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that she must gain her husband's consent in order for her to use any sort of contraceptives, because there are different contraceptives, okay? And these contraceptives can be sometimes harmful to the health of the wife. But anyhow, when it comes to conceiving a child, it's a matter of mutual consent, a mutual agreement, and both parties to the marriage, should agree whether they want to have a child or not, especially the wife.
This actually applies to only the permanent marriages, right?
Permanent marriage, yes,
yeah,
of course.
But the temporary husband?
Yeah, it's out of question because we're not talking about a temporary marriage.
I see. Okay, and let me actually ask you another question regarding, an operation of vasectomy. A man with 4 children underwent an operation of vasectomy without the consent of his wife. So the question is that, is he guilty for not obtaining his wife's approval or consent?
Well, let's understand that the couple have actually 4 children, and they are, there are four children, so the couple do not have any problem about, mm-hmm. yes, not having any children.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that the husband does not need his wife's consent to use any kind of contraceptives, including vasectomy. And he can undergo any operation of vasectomy or use any kind of pills or any kind of contraceptives to prevent pregnancy, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
So the permissibility of such act does not depend on the consent of the wife, and he is not liable.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Savidar, guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws hovering around medical issues based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, is it permissible for a healthy woman for whom pregnancy is not harmful to use any of the contraceptives, such as coitus interruptus, the diaphragm, the pill, and the sterilization? And is it permissible for the husband to impose or force his wife actually to use any methods other than coitus interruptus?
Of course, in itself, there is no problem in doing and using contraceptives or to contraceive, to use any such methods, including coitus interruptus. Of course, mm-hmm. coitus interruptus. I saw some even narrations
right.
to the effect that, okay, in the early period of Islam, some people went to the Prophet, peace be upon him, asking him whether it was allowed to use azl. And azl actually means coitus interruptus.
Mm-hmm.
So the Prophet said that there is no objection. It is quite permissible. So in the early period of Islam, coitus interruptus was practiced, and there was no such other, there was no other method.
Contraceptive methods.
Yeah, and no other method to prevent pregnancy. So based on that very, on those narrations, it can, the scholars have inferred the rule of the permissibility of using any kind of contraceptives method.
Mm-hmm.
So we can say that there is no objection to resorting to any method, any other method, including,
right.
So we did say that coitus interruptus is allowed, but any other method is also allowed. You see, provided that there is a sensible reason behind it and it's not considered to be harmful to the health of the wife mm-hmm. or the husband.
Right.
And of course, as I said, the permission of the husband is required when it comes to the wife using any kind of contraceptive method, because without his consent, it is problematic for the wife.
But it's not the other way around?
Yeah, it's not the other way around. Yes, the husband does not need his wife's permission to use any contraceptive methods.
I see. And
of course, you asked whether it is permissible to force for the husband to force his wife
right.
to use any method other than coitus interruptus. Of course, the husband has no right to force his wife to do so. Yes.
I see. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay with us. Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javed, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws concerning medical issues based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javed. Sheikh Javed, I asked you about, different methods of contraceptives, and you related one of the stories and traditions actually to the Holy Prophet, related to the Holy Prophet, concerning the issue of coitus interruptus, right? And he said that it is actually permissible because we don't have any kind of anything against it, right?
Yes.
So one of those contraceptive methods that prevent pregnancy is actually vasectomy from the start.
Sure.
But what's the general view regarding vasectomy? Is it permissible at all? I mean, generally speaking, or it depends on some kind of conditions?
First of all, I would like to say that Islam encourages men and women to have children.
Mm.
And it is considered to be highly reprehensible if a person decides not to have any children, fearing, for example, hunger or being desperate, thinking that he will not be able to feed them properly or provide them with the means of livelihood and so right. on and so forth. Of course, those people who have such doubt, they do not have strong faith,
mm-hmm.
they do not have tawakkul,
right.
they do not consign their matters to Allah, and they believe that they themselves who provide for the child and who take care of them, who are there, provide them with sustenance. That's not the case. So let's understand
mm-hmm.
that it's Allah who provides actually for the children, who sustain them, and we should not